I'm going to speak today about health systems and what it is, what kind of environment can be provided by way of health systems. What we've had, what are the challenges we face at this point, and how we can go forward. One of the important things that the ICPD Program of Action had done was, in fact, to point to the great importance of the environment within which sexual and reproductive health and rights are advanced. Because if that environment is not supportive and friendly, in a different sense than what Saida just mentioned, then in fact much of what we try to do by way of advancing sexual and reproductive health and rights remains partial and not terribly satisfactory. The last two decades have seen really a patchwork of health sector reforms, which have had very mixed results in general on equity of access and the quality of services in general, but of SRH services in particular. At the same time, our special issue also showcases examples of alternative approaches that can work and the lessons we can learn from them. As our chairperson mentioned at the beginning, among the issues that the special issue highlights, there are three major gaps that it points to, which are all important from the health system's perspective. One, the fact that, and they require urgent attention in the design of the post-2015 agenda. The indicators that will meet the targets under the Open Working Group agreed SDGs on health and gender equality. The first gap is, of course, the big problem of inequalities in SRH services, education, and information, which has left the bottom 40% in terms of income and wealth quite out of the picture, as well as those in rural and remote areas. They've been left quite far behind. So the averages don't really tell us the truth in terms of what is a very, very large proportion of the world's population. The second is the very poor quality of SRH services. Now, you might say that this mirrors the poor quality of health services in general in systems where health services have been quite constrained by lack of resources and so on. This is true. But when it comes to SRH services, we have added dimensions in the poor quality, and that is the added dimensions of gender bias, disrespect, and abuse in service provision, which particularly affect girls and women. And these biases and this discrimination fall short quite often, means that services fall short of meeting not only human rights standards, but in general, but also public health and medical ethics standards quite often. The third big problem that we have is weak, real-time, multi-stakeholder monitoring and review, which means that we have really weak accountability mechanisms. So we can put any kind of policies and programs in place, we can legislate laws, but if we're not able to implement them seriously, we can't move forward, and that implementation really depends upon having multi-stakeholder systems of accountability in place that will ensure that we actually move forward, that will redress inequalities, that will ensure better service quality, and that will also redress and ensure that we don't have continuing violations of human rights, medical ethics, or public health guidelines. Now, quickly, what have been the impact of some of the previous and ongoing health systems reforms? We know some of these quite well. Previous existing health system reforms have functioned with constrained budgets, of rising privatization, and of user fees that have led to rising out-of-pocket spending on health. These have had damaging effects on access and equity in general. And as a result, there's now much experimentation with alternatives. But what happens when it comes to the core SRH services? And by these, of course, we mean contraception, safe abortion, maternity care, prevention and treatment of STIs, including HIV, as well as sexuality education and the prevention and treatment, prevention of violence against women and treatment for survivors of violence, including rape. Often, core SRH services are just not included in a consistent or integrated way. If they're included, they're included as silos, a family planning silo, sitting next to a silo for maternity care, sitting next to a silo for HIV. Not only is this highly inefficient in terms of the use, efficient use of health system resources, but in fact, it ends up with making the seekers of services run around in circles quite often because they have to run from this place to that place for each different service. Highly inefficient from both perspectives. A second big problem with the previous generation of health system reforms has been the exclusion of the needs of adolescents, and previous speakers have stressed this in a number of ways, and I'm not going to go into this. I think in addition to that, reforms have ignored the fact that gender inequalities and power imbalances in decision-making on sexuality and reproduction have a big role in excluding people from access to services, as well as the exclusion of the recognition of the pervasiveness of violence against women and the fear of violence against women that quite often keeps people from accessing services. Another big area is that regressive financial reforms have quite often had deepened the challenges faced in accessing services by girls and women, including not only adolescents, but elderly women and women in the informal economy, the overwhelming majority of working women in low and middle income countries. The irony is that when user fees for services have been removed, yes, access to services has tended to improve, but challenges of poor quality of services and disrespect and abuse of especially marginalized women and girls in healthcare settings remains. So just removing user fees doesn't do it in terms of creating the kind of supportive environment that is needed. Now, very quickly, can universal health coverage, which is often spoken about as the new mantra, the new generation of upcoming health sector reforms, really change this for the better? Let me start out by simply saying that I'm absolutely in support of universal health care and coverage, but I do believe that we have to take into account some very serious caveats. And the caveats will come when I just give you when I say two things. One is the idea of universal health coverage actually underpins SDG 3, which is about ensuring healthy lives and promoting well-being for all at all ages. The core requirements of universal health coverage were spelled out by the WHO in 2013 as ensuring that all people can use the promotive, preventive, curative, rehabilitative, and palliative health services they need, of sufficient quality to be effective, while also ensuring that the use of these services does not expose the user to financial hardship. So here are my caveats. Caveat one, on equity and equality. There are many paths to universality, and not all of them will ensure greater equity of access. There is a temptation for policy implementers to pick the low-hanging fruit. And the low-hanging fruit are typically those that are easy to get to, which actually may lead you to something that has been called the inverse equity hypothesis, that those who get services early are in fact those who can win in the politics of choice and voice, so that those in remote areas, those with less voice like adolescents, poor Dalit rural women in India who are viewed as difficult to reach, get services, if at all, much later. Thereby, the push towards universality actually expands the inequality within the frame. Caveat number two, UHC all too often focuses only on equity in terms of income or wealth inequality, ignoring the multiple and intersecting forms of inequality that can prevent access even where income may not be a challenge. And this is very, very important for us to keep in mind, especially in middle-income countries and for middle-income groups. Third caveat, something that I call path dependence. Which services are chosen? Do we go for those services which will actually give us medium-term but more sustainable results, or do we go again for the quick return, low-hanging fruit? Let's take the example of comprehensive sexuality education. It's very difficult to show quick results from comprehensive sexuality education, but it's one of the best preventive and promotive services for adolescent health, especially for girls. Similarly, programs to prevent violence against girls and women and adolescents. Difficult to show quick results. It's going to take time. And yet, because of that, we may end up not putting in the prevention and promotion needed to make sure that we, in fact, get the results that we need. So for universal health coverage to, in fact, get us where we need to be in terms of SRH services and the fulfillment of rights, we need a combination of system improvements and services that benefit everyone, together with special attention to those whose service and program needs are great, but who may fall behind in the politics of choice and voice. Caveat number four, quality does not automatically flow from universal health coverage, and I won't go into this in more detail. And the fifth caveat is that to get centrality of human rights and medical ethics compliance, health providers simply are at this point not receiving adequate training or supportive supervision to ensure this. And if that doesn't happen, we're not going there in terms of health systems reform. The special issue not only, of course, picks up on some of these challenges, but also draws on examples that show what can be done. So let me say then, very quickly, that in fact, if we are to move forward to ensure that health systems actually meet the needs of what we've learned are the challenges that have emerged over these last 20 years, then we really do need to address these five caveats in a very serious way. The good news is that we do have examples of attempts to make these changes and to move forward, and that the special issue tries to point to some of those.